speak today with a heavy heart. I'm deeply saddened as I take the floor this afternoon. Saddened because we find ourselves embroiled in a conflict in Iraq, a conflict that is involved with insurgents that we fail to acknowledge or recognize, a conflict that is overlaid by sectarian violence between the Shiite Muslims on the one hand and Sunni Muslims on another. Mr. Speaker, this is a great American tragedy. The mission of this Congress is to urge the change of course. We're here today because of a series of irretrievable strategic mistakes. Let's understand the goal of this resolution. Number one, to fully extend our support to those in uniform in the United States. Being on the Armed Services Committee now through the years, and more recently as chairman, I cannot tell you how proud I am of those who are in uniform, whether they be deployed in the Middle East or somewhere else in the globe or here in our country. We must let them know, and this resolution does let them know, that we fully support them as well as their wonderful families. The second part of this resolution deals with the presidential decision to increase our troops by 21,500. However, it's not clear what support troops are needed. Pentagon says 2,500 support troops. The Congressional Budget Office says 13,000 minimum. But whatever it is, we find ourselves not seeing a change in strategy as was promised by the administration and the White House, but just another tactic that had been used before, an increase in troops. No more, no less. We are here to say that's not a good idea. The series of irretrievable mistakes is a serious list. The skewed intelligence that we receive from the Defense Department, Office of Special Plans. The post-war phase of conflict that did not have sufficient planning. Not enough troops, as pointed out by General Ari Shinseki, the former Army Chief of Staff. Allowing the uncontrolled looting and the breakdown of law early on after the occupation began. The dismissal of the Iraqi army rather than giving them a paycheck and a shovel or having them do security work that's important to the stability of that country. The de-bathification that put so many thousands of people, Iraqis, out of business, out of work, including thousands of school teachers. The administration has consistently refused to adjust its overall strategy. And I take no pleasure in this, but it's a moment of I told you so. September the 4th, 2002, and again on March 18th, 2003, I sent letters to the White House predicting some of the deadly outcomes we are experiencing today. And I warned against a jagged ending to the conflict. Now, while there is a peacefully elected Iraqi government, it's a government so divided along sectarian lines, it's not been able to accomplish even the most basic steps needed for national reconciliation. And now we have the president's plan for a troop increase, which is a tactic that we do not approve. The president's plan, I give myself an additional 30 seconds.
The gentleman's recognized for an additional 30 seconds.
The president's plan will embroil our troops even more deeply into the sectarian conflict. Put together hastily, it's insufficient as a requirement for success. 40% of all of the Army equipment of our country is either in Afghanistan or Iraq. The readiness of our troops is in peril. We're stretching the Army and the Marine Corps to the breaking point. That's where we are. And basically, it's because of the conflict in Iraq. Today is an opportunity for us to express our support for the troops and to say it's not a good idea to increase the troop level in Iraq because it has been tried unsuccessfully before.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today in opposition to this resolution. General Petraeus said a resolution like this would discourage the troops. The Secretary of Defense said a resolution like this would embolden the enemy. This Congress should be doing neither of those things. What this resolution will not do is take a position on what we should do as we face the challenge of our generation. President Johnson was criticized a generation ago and still today for choosing bombing sites in Vietnam. He was the commander-in-chief, yet he should have left those tactical choices to the military. But his actions made infinitely more sense than this. It's hard to imagine a group less capable of making tactical decisions about specific troop deployments than 535 members of Congress. The resolution today is about the exact number of troops. Will the one tomorrow or next week be a vote on which block in Baghdad to target or which car to stop? And of course, today what we debate is a tactic in the greater fight we're in. The new commanding general has determined this surge is the right course of action. The Iraq study group was supportive of, quote, a short-term redeployment or surge of American combat forces to stabilize Baghdad or to speed up the training and equipping mission if the U.S. commander in Iraq determines that such a step would be effective, end quote. Mr. Speaker, we can all agree that the current situation in Iraq cannot continue. That's why the president's advanced a new way forward. Actions do have consequences. And this resolution, the Democrats advance today, is a vote for the status quo. It's a vote for the current strategy because it's a vote not to change that strategy. The current strategy isn't working, and as a Southwest Missourian told me yesterday, we're there. He went on to say, it really doesn't matter how we got there or what we thought, we're in a fight that won't stop if we leave. The fact of the matter is that Congress does have the power to end the war if it has the political will to do so. Almost 24 years ago in November of 1983, the Congress voted to withdraw from Lebanon by March of 1984. Many of the proponents of this resolution voted then, who were members of Congress then, voted to leave. They lost 153 to 274, but the message was sent, and we left anyway. And when we left, the myth of American weakness began to take hold in Al-Qaeda. The language of this non-binding resolution doesn't tackle the tough issues of war. It tries to have it both ways, disproving the tactics but supporting the troops. It doesn't say we'll fund the troops in the future or not fund the troops. It doesn't say we'll supply the troops in the future or not supply the troops. This resolution just says enough not to say anything at all. America should see this move for what it really is, a political first step to cutting off funding for the dangerous mission our troops face. The truth is we're at war against a hostile and ferocious enemy that will stop at nothing. Imagine how this debate this week bolsters those radical terrorists whose sole goal is to destroy America. because we disprove, as no society ever has, the dogma of religious totalitarianism that they use every day to recruit followers and funders and suicide bombers. Our diversity, our ability to live together, and the prosperity and vitality that are the result have produced the enemies we face today. As long as we live as we do, they must be wrong. This week, the Congress will send the signal to those enemies and to those who fight to protect us from them that America has the will and indeed the courage to continue fighting these Islamic totalitarianism, these Islamic totalitarians, or that we do not take the consequences of failure seriously.
It's an honor to be here and to be part of this debate. I want to congratulate the bipartisan way in which this resolution was brought before this House, with two members of the Armed Services Committee, the chairman, Ike Skelton from Missouri, and Republican member Jones from North Carolina, and also Chairman Lantos of the Foreign Affairs Committee. I congratulate them in their leadership. At a recent send-off of troops being redeployed from my home district in Missouri, I told the families that I would work in Congress to bring their loved ones home safe, sound, and soon. However, this proposed military escalation flies in the face of that intention. As we enter the fifth year of this mismanaged war in Iraq with an ill-defined plan, it is irresponsible to think that an escalation is in the best interest of our troops. The Bush escalation plan is yet another indication that the President has failed to listen to the American public, military experts, the bipartisan Iraq study group, and Democrat and Republican members in this Congress. Even General Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State, said, "I'm not persuaded that any surge of troops in Baghdad for the purposes of suppressing this communitarian violence, this civil war, will work. It is my solemn responsibility to act on behalf of Missouri constituents and their overwhelming desire for change. I'm proud to see the new Congress has begun to systematically analyze the President's proposal regarding the war in Iraq. Since the beginning of the year, we have already held 52 hearings in this Congress about the war in Iraq, evidence this new Democratic-led Congress is exercising real oversight in demanding accountability on the Iraq war. We will continue to ask the tough questions about the President's plan, continue to insist on a new direction while always putting our troops first. We have the best military in the world, and we owe our troops a clear mission. Our men and women in uniform have done their job two and three times over, and our civilian leadership must provide a clear, achievable objective so they can come home soon. This Congress has a grave duty to listen and take action. Recently, the mother of a young soldier being deployed back to Iraq told me, "Congressman Carnahan, I'm one of those mothers who is against the war in Iraq, but my son volunteered to serve his country. Please be sure they get the support and equipment they need to come home quickly and safely." That mother's heartfelt request is a powerful example of our national unity and resolve to support our troops and oppose this escalation policy that is not making the Iraqi government more self-reliant. In fact, it's using us further as a crutch. It's not making the Middle East region more stable. In fact, many of our military leaders say our very presence there is fueling the insurgency, and it's not making our country safer. Today, the House begins a detailed deliberation on House Concurrent Resolution 63, which is only the beginning of this Congress's oversight of the President's strategy in Iraq. This straightforward resolution plainly expresses our support for the brave men and women who are currently serving or who have served in the armed forces. In my home state of Missouri, over 27,000 men and women have been deployed to serve in Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom since September 2001. It's our duty as members of Congress to ensure they have the necessary training, equipment, resources, and support while in harm's way and when they return home. When debate concludes this week, it is my firm hope that the result will be a bipartisan vote reflecting both our unwavering support of our troops and the reality that a fourth U.S. escalation is the wrong direction for our country. As the new majority, we have the opportunity to develop a comprehensive and common-sense solution to enable us to protect our troops, maintain our obligations, and end this conflict as quickly as possible. We stand ready to provide real peace of mind for the American people by securing our homeland and changing course in Iraq. Great change is possible when this Congress acts in unison with the American public. In the weeks and months ahead, this Congress will act in a bipartisan way to carefully and thoroughly examine the President's proposals and pass decisions through hearings, debate, and oversight, using all tools available to change the direction of this war. Most importantly, we will continue to support our troops in hopes of de-escalation of the war and escalation of the political solution for Iraq. Working together, Mr. Speaker, great change is possible.
We come here today, we spent most of the day on this, to discuss a resolution. It has two parts. The first says that we support our troops, and the second says that we are opposed to the missions, or the mission that the troops are sent on. Now, the problem with a resolution is that it is self-contradictory right up front. If we were going to say we're supporting our troops, we would give them body armor, we would give them up-armored Humvees, we would give them tanks. But would we withhold the most important item in our arsenal, and that is other American fighting men and women? So to say that we're going to support our troops, but we're not going to send them any reinforcements, is on the face of it contradictory. Could you picture Davy Crockett at the Alamo, looking at his BlackBerry, getting a message from Congress? Davy Crockett, we support you. The only thing is, we're not going to send any troops. I'm sure that would really be impressive to Davy Crockett. The second problem with this resolution is that it really misses the job of what congressmen should be doing. Look, I'm an engineer by training. If we're about to make a mistake or we're doing something wrong, I'm open-minded to my Democrat colleagues saying to me, Todd, we're going down the wrong path. That's a bad idea. You should do it this way instead. I was always trained that if you're ready to criticize somebody, you at least offer an alternative. But the problem is with this nifty little resolution, it says we support troops, but we're not going to give them any reinforcements, and then it's blank. There is no recommendation. There is no leadership. They're just saying, we're going to stand on the sidelines and say, it won't work. But don't we owe our soldiers something positive, something specific, a positive recommendation? The Democrats have been elected to majority. That means leadership. That means if you've got a better idea, put it on the table. But if you don't, shut up and don't undermine the morale of our troops and encourage our enemies. That isn't very helpful. Now I've heard people talking about the fact that this is a civil war. This isn't a civil war. If we leave, it'll be what's real civil war. Right now, there's a lot of ethnic clashing and violence. And what is that caused by? Guess what? Terrorists. They said they're doing it intentionally. They blow up a holy place of the Shias, and the Shias react, and they go shoot up a bunch of Sunnis. And so, yeah, but who started all this? Well, of course, it's the terrorists. It's their intention. And do we think if they can destabilize Iraq by fomenting strife between racial groups, that they won't take the same strategy to the other barely stable nations in the Middle East, nations where you have a Sunni leadership and a Shia majority? Are they not going to do the same? Or are you going to say, oh, but it's a civil war, so we can wash our hands of it. It's nothing to worry about. Now, we had the ambassador to Egypt and to Jordan in, and they pleaded with us today, do not rapidly withdraw your troops. And so we started to ask, well, what would happen if we were to do this? Well, nobody knows. But there is one thing we can kind of assume. All the way through history, the history of mankind, whenever there is anarchy, it lasts but a short time. And it is immediately filled with some kind of very strong dictator. Now, do we think that the dictator is going to be a moderate, reasonable sort of guy? Or if we pull out of Iraq immediately, is it not likely that we're going to get an Islamo-terrorist dictator? I think that that makes at least some sense. So then, now what do we have? Now we have Iraq with the oil money supporting it, with this crazy dictator spreading this same kind of radical Islam all over the Middle East. That's a minimum for the scenario of what we're potentially looking at if we rapidly withdraw. Now, it seems to me that all of us as Americans need a little bit of a direction check. And I think sometimes when we need direction, it's helpful to look at the people who came and founded this great nation before us. And so I go back to a question that I ask audiences, not only school kids, but adults. I ask them, what is it that makes America so unique and so precious? What is, if you take an America like an onion and take all the outer layers off, when you get down to the heart, what makes us who we are as a people? And invariably, I hear the word freedom. But that's not quite sufficient, because it isn't quite complete. You see, the people at Tiananmen Square, those little kids in college, wanted freedom, but they greased the treads of Chinese tanks. Just because you want freedom doesn't mean you can have it. There was more to what our founders understood. And they set it forth before we embarked on our first war as a nation, eloquently in our Declaration of Independence. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Rather flowery language. Any idiot should know this. That all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these is life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And our job in government is to protect those God-given rights. It's not just an idea, it was a conviction. People say ideas have consequences. Many idiots have ideas. But an idea that you die for has consequences. And this idea was powerful. It is the engine that has driven America. It has guided us in times of war, because we will say, yes, we believe there are certain fundamental God-given rights that all people are owned. And that is what I taught my son when he was a little kid. Here he is with the Marine Club. Just a little guy, saluting Old Glory with a whole bunch of little kids and some motley uniforms they bought from the used equipment store for military services. Here he is posing, just as proud as can be, founder of the Marine Club, taught that there are some things in this world that are worth dying for. And those convictions are the fact that God gives us life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And I believe America still believes that. There's the little Marine. He's grown up now. That's the cache of terrorist arms that was found in Fallujah. That's the gang that he had the proud opportunity to lead as a second lieutenant in Fallujah, because he believes that there's nothing particularly strange for us to be fighting terrorists. Why would it be so odd for us to fight terrorists? What do terrorists believe? They believe you blow up innocent people. What do we believe? The life is a gift from God. What do terrorists do terrorism for? To take your liberty away, to compel you to do something you don't want to do, to make women into slaves, to take away people's freedom, to take away your liberty. That's what terrorism is for, and that's fundamentally against the idea that God made people to be free. That's why he fights. That's why America has always fought. There's nothing weird or unusual about this. Is it worth fighting terrorists? Is it worth risking your life for freedom? I taught my son yes. When I went over to visit him, together we reaffirmed what we were doing in Iraq. What? Is it so unusual that we have a debate about whether we should be going to war or not? That very first war was over the Declaration of Independence, and there was a gentleman from Virginia who said, what has there been in the conduct? But perhaps maybe we could adjust his words. What has there been in the conduct of the terrorists that gives us any room for hope? The terrorists say the only good Jew is a dead Jew. The only good Christian is a dead Christian. That doesn't leave you a lot of room for negotiation. If we want to stay free, we must fight. Millions of Americans owned that are armed in the holy cause of liberty are invincible by any force which the terrorists may send against us. A just God presides over the destinies of nations. Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of this terrorist running the world? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me and as for my son, we will choose liberty.
I rise to declare my absolute and unwavering opposition to the president's plan to escalate this tragic and unnecessary war. 4 years ago, I stood on the floor of this house to oppose the original force authorization resolution. At the time, some of my colleagues cautioned me that I was taking a risk by opposing the president and failing to support the war against terrorism. But I took that position because I believed then and still believe today that great nations do not start wars as a matter of policy. They exercise diplomacy and negotiation to avert threats and achieve security. The evidence that the administration presented did not clearly establish any imminent threat to our national security. I was convinced that invading Iraq without international support and without unequivocal evidence that Iraq was involved in 9/11 would dangerously drain our military strength, distract us from fighting the very real terrorist threat, and ultimately weaken our credibility around the world. Now we can see that the war in Iraq has emboldened our enemies and provoked the scorn of our allies. Madam Speaker, standing here 4 years later, I can only wish that my assumptions were wrong, that invading Iraq was somehow vital to our national security. We were told that there were weapons of mass destruction, and now we know there were no WMDs. We were told that Iraqi oil revenue would pay for this war, and now we know that that was only a pipe dream that has cost American taxpayers over $400 billion. We were told that our troops would be greeted as liberators, and now we know that was only wishful thinking based on neocon fantasies and not the facts. Today, American troops are embroiled in a bloody quagmire that has already resulted in over 26,000 American casualties. And now, just this past week, the Defense Department Inspector General reported that senior administration officials engaged in a deliberate misinformation campaign about Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Now we have learned that officials in our government deliberately distributed altered intelligence assessment. Such a misinformation campaign is unconscionable and a greater threat to our national security than any act of terrorism. We are all familiar with the historian's observation that great nations are not conquered by outside forces until the nation has destroyed itself from within. I implore my colleagues to heed the lessons of history. Do not allow the politics of deception to distort reality. This administration is denying the facts. It has repeatedly misled the Congress and the American people and undermined our nation's integrity throughout the world. Now the president is asking Congress to register more support for a policy failure, escalating the military violence in Iraq by injecting 21,000 more U.S. troops into a civil war. This reflects nothing more than this administration's obstinate refusal to face present realities. And a vast majority of Americans want a responsible end to this war as soon as possible. They want our troops redeployed. They want us to alleviate the suffering of innocent Iraqis. And they want us to finally tell the Iraqi people that they must be engaged in their country's destiny. The future of Iraq must ultimately be determined by them, not by us. And I want to conclude by quoting a good friend of mine and a fellow colleague, the distinguished chairman of the Armed Forces Committee, Ike Skelton. And in a recent statement, he said, "Only the Iraqis can change the situation there and bring lasting security to their nation. I remain convinced that a gradual and responsible redeployment of U.S. forces is the best way to help the Iraqis take responsibility for their security and to restore the full strength of our military."
It literally breaks my heart to be here today. Young Americans from my district have gone to Iraq, and we have lost some of our best, brightest soldiers. One of the finest men I ever met, who I had the privilege of appointing to West Point, lost his life in Iraq just last September. I feel responsible in part. We all are in part. Very little has been asked of most Americans in this war, but too much has been asked of a very few. If anything comes from this debate, Mr. Speaker, I hope it is a consensus for our responsibilities in this conflict. This House is about different points of view, speech, and debate in an institution that belongs to the people. Our nation is protected by the bravest of the brave who leave their homes and families to stand guard on foreign shores. Some of them are the first in their families to wear the uniform of our country. Others have done so for generations. These young men and women hold dear connections to every town in America. We are wrapping the fallen in our flag. They deserved the best planning, the clearest execution, the utmost care in their deployments, and heroes' welcomes when they return. But it is not enough to give them parades. It is not enough to give amputees the best VA care, nor is it enough to bury them well. We cannot allow their service to be undermined. Congress and the administration have been locked in a struggle to show the proper support very nearly from the beginning of this war. Personnel armor, communications equipment, vehicle kits, the things these Americans need, not for comfort, but to preserve their lives amid grave danger, have in some cases been supplied by soldiers' families and others because the Department of Defense, which received $500 billion last year, has run out. Supply chain issues abound. Training has been incomplete or insufficient for the new demands on our troops. I still cannot discern a clear articulation of the mission of these men and women in the field. I loathe revisiting these failures, but responsible representation demands we do so. Every American knows that America cannot do the work of Iraq's natural allies. We cannot supplant Iraq's neighbors who depend on the nation's viability for their own stability. We can be many things in Iraq, but we cannot be all things to Iraq. We can make good on our commitment to American troops serving in Iraq, and here's how. We can offer them the support of a robust American diplomatic corps to do jobs which our soldiers should not have to do, and to avoid conflicts and enemies they should not have to engage. We can secure funds for Iraq that guarantee our soldiers have the gear and training they need to stay safe, and that means more than writing the taxpayer's check. That means diligent, scrutinizing oversight of how our money is spent. We can assure that the deployment of American troops is deliberate in every way. We can offset the engagement of American troops far from home with the engagement of Iraqi troops in their own cities and towns. We can speed this transition by immediately securing Iraq's borders, by providing aggressive training to Iraqi units, and by lending our expertise to building Iraqi institutions, in addition to building the Iraqi army. We can do these things, and we must. We can do much more than debate a non-binding resolution, one that allows politics to creep into the question of support for our troops at a time when our support must be complete and it must be unquestioned. The liberation of Iraq means more than words and more than weapons. Liberation needs democracy, libraries, schools, and economic stability, steady work and clean water, safe streets as well as safe passage. The measures of this progress must be widely known, and the planners of this war must be completely accountable. Every day we do not define the terms of progress, we lay a grave transgression at the feet of the mothers of the fallen, of the brothers of the killed, of the soldiers who were just far enough away from the IEDs that when it exploded, they lost their limbs but not their lives. Mr. Speaker, I cannot lend my support to this resolution. It sets too poor a precedent in this Congress when our standards for action must be high. Words cannot replace deeds in support of our American troops.
Madam Speaker, on November the 19th of 1863, President Abraham Lincoln rose on the platform at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, following a two-hour oration by Edward Everett, and gave a brief but very eloquent discourse that has become a prominent part of our country's heritage. At the dedication of the Gettysburg National Cemetery, he acknowledged, quote, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced," end quote. Can we find some poignancy today in those simple words uttered 74 years ago? What is the unfinished work that confronts this body politic? And more to the point, does this resolution promulgated unilaterally by the majority advance the cause of freedom for which 3,000 of our countrymen have given the last full measure of devotion? For all of these rhetorical meanderings that have occurred, lo, these many hours, the responsibility for the current state of affairs in Iraq rests squarely with the majority of members who serve in this Congress of the United States. Back on December 17, 1998, do you recall House Resolution 612, which declared in pertinent part, resolved that Congress reaffirms it should be the policy of the United States to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power and, quote, to promote the emergence of a democratic government to replace that regime, end quote. I note that the gentleman who just spoke, along with 400 other members of the Congress, supported that resolution as the policy of the United States. And thereafter, in October 2002, Congress, both House and Senate, approved the resolution authorizing the use of force and military action necessary to effectuate that policy of regime change. Now, deposing the former dictator was, in relative terms, the easy part, yanking him from his hiding place, a hole in the ground. He eventually stood trial in the dock as a common accused, was judged by his countrymen according to the rule of law, and held to account for the brutality of his many crimes. The second policy objective, promoting a democratic government, has been the harder path. But though difficult, is it no less important? As my friend and colleague, my classmate from New Mexico, Ms. Wilson, so passionately and persuasively enunciated yesterday, America has vital national interests in Iraq. Does anyone argue the contrary? Can we not all agree that we must deny Al-Qaeda sanctuary in Iraq? Do we not further agree that Iraq must not be the source of instability in the Middle Eastern region? Well, if we can agree on these points, can the majority make a legitimate case that this resolution accomplishes either of those important interests? You know, President Bush recently nominated General David Petraeus as the new commander of multinational force in Iraq. Widely known as a brilliant tactician in the area of counterinsurgency, General Petraeus was unanimously confirmed by the other body. Today, however, the majority desires to deny this extremely capable commander the means to accomplish his objective. Isn't it incumbent upon us, as Lincoln urged, to remain dedicated to the task remaining before us? Haven't many in this body expressed frustration that the Iraqi government has put limitations on rules of engagement of our troops in the field, not allowing our military to hunt down the enemy because insurgents had escaped to a safe haven in a region deemed off-limits by the Iraqi government? Well, isn't the majority party doing exactly the same thing half a world away with this resolution? Isn't denying military additional reinforcements deemed necessary by our generals in the field hampering our last best chance for success? Two nights ago, I was moved by the quiet eloquence of the distinguished gentleman from New York, Mr. McHugh, when he made this simple yet ironic observation. At no time in our nation's history has this House considered a public rebuke of a sitting commander-in-chief for the manner in which a war has been conducted that Congress itself has authorized. On that score alone, I find this resolution breathtaking in its audacity. If I may be allowed to paraphrase the great emancipator, it is true. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but the world will never forget what we do here. I urge rejection of this resolution.
Mr. Speaker, as I began to consider the comments I would make during this debate tonight on the occupation, escalation, and gravitation of the U.S. military action in Iraq, I concluded that my visit to this well must somehow echo the fret and frustration of the people who sent me to represent them in the People's House. Tomorrow, the United States of America should begin a massive and voter-mandated salvaging operation in Iraq. Yes, as bad as conditions have gotten, there are important and valuable things that can be salvaged. A tarnished international image clings to a nation like a shadow to a human being. It follows a nation to the next world crisis. It cannot be blamed for faulty intelligence, and it spoils opportunities to influence a world desperate for direction. Henceforth, we must conduct our foreign policy in a manner which salvages our sunken international image. Because of the way we launched a Lone Ranger military action in Iraq, our prestige among the community of nations has surely suffered. Nothing deflates as a punctured international image. We can salvage our image not only by de-escalating in Iraq, but also by reestablishing desperately needed dialogue with all the sovereign nations in the neighborhood with Iraq. It takes many, many people, and not just one, to put a policy together. Now, with regard to the peace in the Middle East, it has become crystal clear that the United States cannot whistle a symphony. It will take an orchestra of many international players willing to make music in the same key. The days of the international soloist or a conductor without an orchestra are past. We must salvage our relationship with the family of nations. We must salvage what is left of our treasury. Mr. Speaker, for most Americans, war does not pay, but it must be paid for. And to date, we have spent billions and billions of dollars that could have been spent for valuable programs to set this nation on the right course. We must salvage soldiers. Yes, thousands of brave young U.S. soldiers have been killed, and Iraqis are dying weekly by the hundreds. If this conflict continues, there will be only two classes of young people, one half in graves, the other half in hospitals. Some have said this conflict would last for decades. Nevertheless, that kind of policy, or lack thereof, has caused young Americans to ask, will we ever see the last of this war, or will it see the last of us? The Kansas City Chiefs is my team. The general manager, Carl Peterson, would never go to the sports editors of the local media and admonish them not to criticize the game plan of Coach Herman Edwards, because to do so would demoralize the players. Such a warning by the general manager would be ludicrous, if not loony. Why? Because the players of the Kansas City Chiefs or professionals who cannot be so easily defamed. And friends, neither can the men and women who form the fiercest fighting force in the history of this planet. After all the ethnic and sectarian human butchering, after all the billions spent, after all the children of God killed, after all the maimed who have been hospitalized, after all the dissenters who have been heard, after all the purple thorns that have been raised, the war drum still throbs, the sabers still rattle, and the blood still flows. Yet, we can salvage the soul of the nation, even though at this hour we seem to have lost our way. Tomorrow, this Congress must adopt House Concurrent Resolution 63 as a bold and beckoning to begin salvage operations.